Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In recent years, there have been a number of new biographies published that explore the lives of America's founding fathers. And while that is all well and good, there are many scholars who would argue that we have unjustly overlooked the contributions made by the partners of these men, the women that we might well call America's founding mothers. This morning, in this first hour of the show, we'll be talking with one such scholar. Our guest is Catherine Allgaier. She is Associate Professor of History at the University of California at Riverside, and she's the author of a recently published biography of Dolly Madison, wife of James Madison, the fourth President of the United States. The title is A Perfect Union, Dolly Madison and the Creation of the American Nation. Henry Holt is the publisher for the book, and it came out last spring. She points out that there are a lot of people who remember Dolly Madison really for just one thing, and that is for having saved a painting of George Washington from being destroyed when the British attacked and burned Washington, D.C. during the War of 1812. However, she argues that there was much, much more to Dolly Madison than this. She says that Dolly was a master politician. She performed many political acts to further her husband's goals, wooing supporters, lobbying for his policies, actively peddling influence. Along the way, says our guest, Dolly Madison helped the federal government to evolve along democratic lines, and she secured Washington City, what we now know as Washington, D.C., as the permanent capital of the new nation. In this hour, we'll be talking about the life of Dolly Madison with our guest, Catherine Allgaier, and questions certainly are welcome. All we ask is that people are brief so that we can keep moving along and getting as many as possible. But anyone who is listening is welcome to call. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455 at any point here. If you have questions, you're welcome to give us a call. Professor Allgaier, hello.
David, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And yourself?
Greetings from California.
Very good. Well, we certainly appreciate you giving us some of your time. I'm interested in the fact that your entry into this subject really comes from a more general interest as a scholar that you had in the ways that women participated in politics in the time before they had the right to vote. And that you had, in fact, written some about Dolly Madison before, but apparently felt that she deserved a more thorough treatment of her life.
Oh, my goodness, yes. I have to say I was interested in political women, and because apparently I like things to be tough, I was interested in the time before they had the right to vote. So if the theory is that politics is a human activity and everybody wants to politic, what do you do when you're excluded from the official political machine because you happen to be a woman or a person of color? And how do you work out that political impulse? And when I wanted to study that, I looked to Washington, D.C. in the early days. And it seemed to me, David, it was like a petri dish for politics. Because unlike the older cities in the former colonies, Washington City was a town built for, by, and about politics. And so I thought that if there was any way that women could be political, it would be at this site where the federal government was just starting and there was nothing to do but politics. And that was my first book. It was called Parlor Politics, in which the ladies of Washington helped build a city and a government. And in that book, I uncovered this system, this sort of alternative power structure that women had created. And along the way, David, as you mentioned, I encountered Dolly Madison, and I hadn't known anything about her, you know, except ice cream and cakes and pies. And I found her to be the exemplar of everything I was trying to say. And imagine my surprise to discover there had been no modern biography for, there was no modern biography, so therefore there was no scholarly treatment of her life. And I thought, even though I had written a whole chapter on her in my first book, I thought she does deserve a treatment just of her own, on her own merits.
Mm-hmm. Certainly it is true that the men who were among the first to be president of the United States, in a very real sense, invented the office from George Washington on. So it is also true that their wives invented the job of first lady, even though the the term wasn't coined until somewhat later. Dolly Madison was preceded by two remarkable and formidable women, Martha Washington and Abigail Adams. So certainly they had some role in creating the office of First Lady. Abigail Adams was the first to live in the White House. But I think you make the argument that perhaps as much or more than Martha Washington and Abigail Adams, it was Dolly Madison who really crafted, defined the role of First Lady.
Oh, there's no doubt about that. And this is not to have any disrespect for Martha Washington or Abigail Adams. Martha Washington didn't really like the job of being the president's wife. She wished she could just stay at home in Virginia with her husband. She was uncomfortable, in fact, with the attention that seemed to be thrust upon her. And it was a certain kind of attention, David. It was a projection, and she didn't other people's desires and values, and she shied away from that. And as far as Abigail Adams goes, in a way, she was much more like a male politician than a female politician of her time. That is that she was very interested in the theoretical operation of politics. She was very interested in legislation, on theories of governance, and she was a very unenthusiastic, you know, official hostess. Sadly, I have to say that the thing she had the most influence over was the Alien and Sedition Act, which is not great, but, you know, she was much more interested in the theoretical underpinnings of politics. So by the time Dolly comes along, she really can start from scratch. And, you know, you said something about the men inventing the office of president, and that's true because, as you know, in that blueprint for our government, the Constitution, there's not much said about anything, really, the presidency or how it's going to work. And it's also true of something else, which I call the office of the ceremonial. And the office of the ceremonial is very important in politics and in governments. And a lot of governments, all sort of modern governments and old-fashioned governments had it. It was sometimes divided. The easiest way to think about it is present-day Great Britain, where, you know, the prime minister runs the government and the royal family is the sort of ceremonial function. But the founding fathers were very wary of this function, the ceremonial. They associated it, quite rightly, with kings and court and pomp. And so they deliberately eliminated it from our government. The only ceremony we have built into our government is the inauguration, and again, there's not much said about it. But as it turns out, all governments need the ceremonial, and strangely enough, David, all governments that are just starting really need it. So when you're trying to create a new nation from scratch, you really need the kind of psychological effect of the ceremonial, and that's what Dolly Madison really developed.
Mm. It's really interesting to look at the lives of the three women. They were certainly very different, as you say, and from what I read about Martha Washington, it seems that one of the things that she was very concerned about was guarding her personal, her private, her family life. She wanted that to be insulated from the responsibilities and the pressures and everything that came with the fact that her husband was the president of the United States. Abigail Adams, interestingly, was in many ways, I think people would argue, in many ways, the intellectual equal of her husband, someone who was very important for him as a kind of sounding board, as someone they had this remarkable, wonderful correspondence where they wrote back and forth, and that was very important to him. And it's interesting that Dolly Madison was no less important, and yet she really recognized how important to politics and the business of politics, getting things done, what we would now call networking, and how important the informal, the social sphere was to do that, because, you know, as we know, so much of what happens in government, what makes things go, doesn't happen in the halls of Congress, really. It certainly doesn't happen in the chamber. It doesn't happen on the floor. It's all the stuff that happens in all of the other less official spaces and things where people get together in less formal, in more social settings. And it seemed that she seemed to recognize just how important those settings were and how she and her husband and their supporters could use that to their advantage to get done what they wanted to get done.
Oh, absolutely. And I think you've characterized each of those women correctly. I just have to say there's a marvelous, fairly new book about Martha Washington by Patricia Brady that gives a real good picture of exactly, as you say, a woman who wants to keep her family separate. And Abigail Adams was indeed the intellectual equal, I think, of her husband, and at some point he was quite estranged from his cabinet. She was his sole cabinet advisor, which, again, the Alien Sedition Act's not your best legacy, but hey, you know. But Dolly Madison, while an intelligent woman, was concerned more with what we think of as practical realities, and this is exactly what the country needed at the time. So the American Revolution is over, and whatever date you want to put on it, 1781 or 83, and now the Founding Fathers are faced with the task of creating a world. And what they have is a lot of theory. They draw on, you know, centuries of theory to create the government. But now it has to actually run. And the story of Dolly, I always think, is apologies, David, to Star Trek. It's the story of the next generation of how do we take this theory of government, which was called republicanism with a small r, and make it work on the ground. And that's what she did. And by taking a theory and applying it to reality, as it so often happens, it changes the actual reality. So we know that our founders did not set up a democracy. They set up a republic. But it was in the actual working out of that that we get the democracy. And I'd also like to say something, too, about this idea of the social events. One of the things that my work insists on, gently insists on, is that we actually understand this social world for what it is. And, of course, I always say I'm a scholar of things everybody already knows. So anybody who's even, you know, worked in a corporation knows there's a lot of business that gets done on the golf course or at brunch. We all sort of know that those social events are important, but when it comes to writing big books of important history, nobody looks at that. And so I give this an actual name. I call it the unofficial sphere. So I say for politics to get done, just generally, you need two spheres of action. And one is the official sphere, which is the sphere of, you know, legislation and treaties and paper, and it's the product, if you will. But you also need the unofficial sphere, and the unofficial sphere is about process. So it's at the parties and the social events and out in the halls where people can explore ideas, where they can take political risks, where they can do things they can't do in the official sphere. And because the unofficial sphere is often at social events, then women are important. So, you know, what you're talking about, this dynamic of work at social events, I actually put in a kind of political model.
Mm-hmm. One more sort of general question, and then I want to ask some more detailed things and perhaps get in a little bit more depth about her life. As a general kind of question, do you think that had John Madison been married to someone else, that it, perhaps his presidency would not have been as successful as it was?
Oh, I can, yes. I mean, you know, David, I'm a professional historian. We're not allowed to wonder counterfactually. But if you got me alone with a martini, I would definitely tell you this. Because she served some very particular functions, and we'll talk more in detail about that, but I'll just say one thing. You mentioned earlier in your very kind introduction about James Madison's goals for the country. So what were they? Well, at that time, a big goal was union. The country was, you know, 20 years into the Republican experiment. Things weren't going well. People still weren't sure whether this loose confederation of states was going to hold. Now, that had always been true, right? But now it was getting worse because America was adding territory, and the situation abroad was getting dicier, right? It's going to lead to the War of 1812. And so there was a real worry about unity and union. And you could argue, looking back at James Madison's presidency, that he came so close to losing the Union, just a hair's breadth, went to war in this disastrous way, which only further split the Union. But at the end of his presidency, the people around him, Americans, all thought he had done a great job. And the reason they did was because they had a deep psychological feeling about union. And that psychological feeling has as much to do, if not more, with Dolly Madison's efforts. So while James Madison is struggling to hold the country together through official means, Dolly Madison is free to embody union and patriotism and hold the whole thing together. So it's not a coincidence that she's famous for saving the portrait. It's not just because she saved the portrait and therefore she's famous. It's because she had become a symbol for America before that and after that, a symbol of a union. So I would say to you that even if James Madison's presidency didn't change in any appreciable way, that is, we would have still gone to war with England, our feelings about it would have been quite different, and those feelings are important.
Our guest this morning in this part of Focus 580, Catherine Allgaier. She is Associate Professor of History at University of California, Riverside, is the author of a recently published biography of Dolly Madison, wife of James Madison, fourth president of the United States. The title of her book is A Perfect Union, Dolly Madison and the Creation of the American Nation, and it's published by Henry Holt. She's also the author of an earlier book that looks at the women of Washington of the time and their involvement in politics and ways in which women were force in politics before the time where they could vote. That book is Parlor Politics, in which the ladies of Washington help build a city and a government. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. One of the things that I think to me is interesting about her is the fact that she was born a Quaker to a family that was not particularly prosperous. So she certainly, as a young woman, was not part of anybody's upper crust. And at the same time, though, when she went to Washington, D.C., she was very much involved in creating, and we'll put it in quotes, creating Washington society, something that she really, a kind of world that previously she wouldn't really not have lived in. And how is it she made the transition from her upbringing to the doyenne of Washington society?
You know, I think that her upbringing was mixed. It was it's sort of strange. You call it Washington society. I'll be even more overt and call it the ruling class. But in some ways, she was quite poised for that. Dolly Madison was born within a kin circle of the Virginia gentry. Now, these people, not her family particularly, they had some bad luck, but this world that she was born in is the slaveholding Virginia gentry. These are people with huge parcels of land who'd been in the country for two or three generations, which was a long time at that point. And they're those people, in other words, David, who got there first and got the good land. So she could have lived out her life in the Virginia gentry and been one of the more prosperous people had she married well, you know, in the country, but not necessarily famous. It was a rural life, but there it was. The big difference, though, as you point out, is that she was Quaker. And this is in a world, I say it's largely, if laxly, Anglican landscape. Most, you know, people in the Virginia gentry are just sort of some form of Episcopalian. But they were Quakers, the Paines, and because of that, they made a couple of disastrous moves. And the first one, Dolly Madison wasn't even born yet. Her family gave up their land in Virginia, and they went out to the frontier at that time, which was North Carolina, to live in a very small, isolated, concentrated Quaker community, and that's where Dolly was born. She's actually born in a log cabin on the North Carolina frontier. But something went terribly wrong, we don't know what it was, and they moved back at a loss and lived, you know, among this kin circle for a while. So she's growing up among people who consider themselves the top of their heap in their little world. But then when Dolly was about 15 or so, something else happened that changed her life. Out of Quaker conscience, her father decided to give up his slaves, and since you can't run a farm without enslaved people, he moved the whole family to Philadelphia, and he became a starch merchant. And it was a shock to her because, can you imagine just going from Virginia to a cold northern city in Philadelphia and, you know, just having your whole world change? And things didn't go well for the Paines there. You know, terrible things happened to them. You know, children died, and her father died, and she had her first marriage there. She had two children. Then her husband died, and one of her sons died. Dreadful things happened. But what was also happening in Philadelphia at the time was it was the capital of the new United States. And because the Paines had such a hard time financially, her mother opened a boarding house. And I know that has a disreputable sound now, but it was quite respectable at the time because these were, you know, rooms for legislators. And there Dolly met many of the great men of her day. So in a weird way, you know, because she was brought up in the Virginia gentry and because she'd had this exposure to the political men, she was somewhat prepared to take her position as the leader of Washington society. But I do argue, you know, David, that she's a genius, a political genius. And nothing can totally explain her gifts because... you're right, she wasn't totally groomed for this, but she went with it, and she became, you know, not just a good political wife, but the most famous one in the country. So, and like all geniuses, nothing in her background can entirely account for her accomplishment. Mm.
As you mentioned, before marrying Mr. Madison, she was married. He was a man named John Todd, who died of yellow fever. There was a big epidemic of yellow fever in Philadelphia in the early 1790s. They were only married for, I think, about 4 years. How then did she go on to meet John Madison?
Well, yes, this is a great yellow fever epidemic of 1793. And, of course, it took her second son as well. And after the yellow fever epidemic, and you can imagine Philadelphia was just, it was just decimated. She's a young widow. She's 25. She had actually spent the time of the plague outside the city. She comes back to the city, and she starts trying to sort of rebuild her life. She's got, you know, family around, but not too much. And she's sort of adrift. But she's beautiful. She's a very attractive woman. And she's a widow, and she's rich. Not terribly rich, but she's got some money. So she's not destined to remain on the shelf for too long. And the family legend has it that she was so pretty that men would walk along the streets, and as they passed her, they would turn around and look. And she's a Quaker, dressing very plainly at this time, and her friend Eliza Collins Lee said, you know, Dolly, you must hide your face because men are staring at you. And so one figures that probably James Madison was one of those men watching her. And again, according to family legend, he asked Aaron Burr to introduce him, which is very tricky, David, because Aaron Burr was a famous womanizer. I'm not sure I would ask him to introduce me to any woman, but I don't know. And so she, you know, met him. And again, this is a family legend, but when Dolly heard that James Madison wanted to meet her, she wrote to her best friend Eliza, and she said, you must come and be with me tonight. The great little Madison wants to meet me. So this is actually fairly quickly after her husband dies. So her husband dies in the fall of 1793, and by spring 1794, so, you know, just a really few months later, James Madison is courting her. And he is pressing his suit. He's in his early 40s and has never married, which is quite unusual in those days. So my theory is that he's a romantic. So he's been waiting for someone. And he had had a youthful romance that slipped away, so he wasn't going to let her get away. So he, you know, we sort of assume they met around March or April. By August, he's pressing her to marry him, and she does agree to do that. And she marries him in September of 1794, which is a little less than a year after her husband dies, which is a bit scandalous.
Apparently, Madison fell for her really hard, and she didn't go head over her heels and for him. Apparently, also the story goes though that Martha Washington said to her, "Okay, darling, take this guy. This is good for you. Do this." And I don't know again whether that is true or not. But what exactly were her feelings for Madison?
Oh, my goodness. I wish we knew that for sure, David.
About the Martha Washington thing?
Oh, yeah. Well, about Martha and about her feelings. She wrote a very famous letter on her wedding day. So here's a woman about to go downstairs and get married. They marry in Virginia. And there's a wedding party. You know, it's not a huge wedding, but there's family in there. And she's writing this letter, again, to her best friend, Eliza. And she says, you know, here I am on my wedding day. And, you know, and she talks about what a good man James is and how good he'll be for her young son, John Payne Todd, that everybody called Payne, and how she, Dolly, has made provision for Payne, you know, with her first husband's money. She talks about financial affairs, but she doesn't wax rhapsodic about this great guy she's marrying. But, you know, marriage was a very important step in a woman's life, and it was one fraught with much danger. Sometimes they would call it the dark leap because, you know, you were just taking your life in your hands. Because once a woman married a man, she was in his power. She ceased to have a legal identity. Unless provision was made, any property she had would fall into his hands. She was basically ceding control of her life to this person. So Dolly might be forgiven for not necessarily just going with the whole love thing and being a bit more prudent. Remember, the marriage ceremony at the time said, you know, marriage is an honorable state and must be entered into soberly and discreetly. These aren't exactly the most romantic words in the world, but that's really what marriage was. The extraordinary thing, I think, for us to figure out as moderns is after their marriage, Dolly did fall in love with him. And she and they were very close as a couple. And part of the reason, I think, and this is why, by the way, I've been quoted as saying that Thomas Jefferson is the founding father I'd least like to date, but I date James Madison, is that he allowed her to become the person she was destined to be. So he not only loved her, but he was secure enough to allow her to develop her astonishing political potential. And you could be cynical and say that, well, he was the chief beneficiary of it, but it's true that there are other men in this period who are also married to astonishing political women who are not secure enough to let their wives develop. So I think that, you know, whatever she felt on her wedding day, it's unquestionably that as they lived together and were husband and wife, they were a very loving couple.
So on one level, your title, The Perfect Union, refers to the relationship between Dolly and James?
Yes, a little bit. I mean, certainly because of the whole title, the Perfect Union was, you know, that the nation needed someone like Dolly, and there she was. Mm-hmm. I mean, one could argue that history is made when extraordinary people face extraordinary circumstances, and that's true. But it definitely has a secondary reflection on Dolly and James, because they seem to really complement each other amazingly.
Our guest, Catherine Allgaier, is Associate Professor of History at the University of California, Riverside, and is the author of a book that was published this past spring, officially in April. I'm sure you can find it still out in the bookstores. The title is A Perfect Union, Dolly Madison and the Creation of the American Nation, published by Henry Holt. Questions are welcome, and I think we have someone here ready to go. Others who are listening certainly are welcome to call in.
If
you're here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, that's the number. We do also have a toll-free line, so that means if it would be a long-distance call for you, use the toll-free line. The call's on us. That's 800-222-9455. First caller here is in Urbana, and it's line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I really appreciate this interview. I'd like the professor to perhaps expound a little bit on the age difference between, I think it was the widow Todd or Dodd, I'm not sure, and James Madison, who was, I think, well into his 40s when they married. And also on the fact that when she became First Lady, there had been an absence of a First Lady because Jefferson was a widower. And I'll just leave those 2 points there. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. You can go ahead and respond to those.
Yes. There was quite an age difference. She was, depending on how you date the birthdays and everything, 16 or 17 years. Dolly was in her mid-20s, and it is the widow Todd with a T as in Tom. And James was in his early 40s. And I think what's significant about that, first, I think part of it is just very understandable. She was a young, vibrant, beautiful woman. She remained beautiful to the end of her life, but there's no question that at 25, she was a little over the normal height for a woman. She had a very curvaceous figure, a beautiful complexion, hair that was so dark brown that it looked black, and these amazing blue eyes. So I don't think we need to go into an in-depth analysis of what James Madison saw. But I think that it's important to, and you were asking this question, too, about why Dolly was attracted to James. And I think it's also that he represented something to her. You know, when she married James Madison, she had to for once and for all renounce her Quaker roots, because she married out of the Quaker faith, and so she was read out of meeting. And that would seem to be a huge step. But it's not as drastic as it sounds, I think, because James Madison was a member of the Virginia gentry, what he promised to her, in a way, was a return to the world of her childhood. It was also the return to a world of chattel slaveholding, which, again, that just seems so tough to go from a family who repudiated slavery back into that world. But I think, you know, he was just old enough to be a little bit paternal. He was established. He had his own home, Montpelier in Orange, Virginia. And so he offered her something that maybe a young man couldn't, which was a place in the Virginia world that she had to leave when she was 15. And it is true, I have to say, the gentleman is quite correct, that for the first 8 years of Washington's existence, Washington City's existence, there was no First Lady. As you pointed out, David, Abigail was there, but just for a few months, and she hated it. She famously hung her laundry in the East Room. But really, from Jefferson's tenure, which is, say, 1801 to 1809, there was no First Lady. And it's often said that Dolly was the, quote, unofficial hostess at the White House. That's a little deceiving, because the truth was Jefferson didn't want women involved in politics. You know, whenever I'm trying to make the case for my work, I just have to point to my actual subjects, and their fear and loathing of women in politics has to be a clue as to how important they were. So to eliminate women from politics during his time as president, Jefferson eliminated many, many social events, big levees and parties where women and other what he called unofficial characters could gather. And in fact, his social calendar mostly were these tiny little dinners with hand-selected congressmen, all from one party or the other, where he had total control over the conversation. That was Jefferson's style. So the few times that there were women, yes, Dolly was there. But what's most important to me is that as Jefferson is carefully controlling congressmen at his dinner table, Dolly Madison is creating a social world in her house on F Street, where her husband was living, you know, because he was the Secretary of State. And this is amazing, because apparently she did this so well that Jefferson never, you know, she was flying under his radar. But it was soon clear that the place to go in Washington City was not the president's house. It was the house on F Street. And she created a wonderful social world there, where indeed the business of diplomacy got done at certain points, and lots of political business.
Mm-hmm. As you say, the Madisons came to Washington. They came to Washington in 1801. Mm-hmm. Jefferson was president. They came because James was going to be Secretary of State. And this was at a time when Washington, what was then called Washington City, had not been the capital all that long. And it sounds like, from the way that you, in the way that it has been described, is that it sounds that actually might have been kind of grim in those early days.
Yes. It wasn't grim if you liked nature. the government officially moved to Washington in 1800. That's why Abigail was there at the White House for a few months. But really, it began when Jefferson came in 1801. And, you know, it's a beautiful spot. Contrary to all stereotypes, it is not a swamp, but though the heat is amazing in the summer. But, you know, I would say the people who came to Washington who saw the nature were optimistic, because they said it's so beautiful, it's so green, it's filled with all these beautiful birds and plants and all that. But people who came expecting to see a city were appalled. It was a very undeveloped, unfinished city. And in fact, it's interesting. I mean, it's almost like a novel. If we talk about the political theory of the theoretical political situation the nation was in, it was mirrored by the Capitol. The Capitol was isolated from the rest of the nation. It was unfinished. It was undeveloped. It wasn't practical. And what I think is the most symbolic part of it is that the roads in between, you know, say the president's house and Congress and the Supreme Court and everywhere else were so bad that people regularly were stuck in the mud, and people didn't know where they were. So if that isn't a metaphor for, you know, government, I don't know what is.
The, I think something I think probably people perhaps don't appreciate as much as they should about what politics at this time was like. I think they don't appreciate just how rough. I mean, we think politics is bad today. politics at this time was so rough, so bare knuckle. There was so much in the way of personal attack and really ugly stuff said about people appearing and also appearing in print. The newspapers at the time had no hesitancy to print stuff like that. The press was very partisan, and it must have been at times the political atmosphere must have been really ugly. How did she negotiate her way through that?
You know, I think that's a great point, because we like to, our situation is pretty rough too, but there's a significant difference, I think, in her time. And I also have to say that gets us to what I consider her lasting historical significance. You know, David, if you're lucky, when you write a biographical, you know, study, your only onus is to prove that the person you're writing about was important in their time. And there's just no question that Dolly Madison was important in her time. And the book talks about how she developed the White House and how she became a charismatic figure for her husband's administration and a symbol of nationalism, and how she built this unofficial sphere that Washington needed. So she's definitely important in her time. But if you're lucky as an author, your subject has a lasting significance. And I think her lasting significance lies in this ability to mitigate really, as you say, bare-knuckle political circumstances. You know, this is the era of Congress behaving badly. This is where people are, you know, beating each other with canes on the floor of Congress, and they're murdering each other in duels. It's rough. But you have to understand that for these people, there was a lot at stake. There was the existence of the nation, whether it was going to live or not. And these people did not believe in political parties. So the difference is, we're supposed to know, David, we're really supposed to know that the bipartisan system we have is the strength of our system. But these people didn't know that. These male politicians thought that only one party could exist, and any opposition was considered not just disagreement, but treason. So now you can sort of understand that that's why the fighting was so fierce. They felt like they were, you know, not just quarreling for the soul of the nation, as sometimes the cable news networks tell us now, but the actual existence. And if any opposition is seen as treason, you can see why it had to be attacked, sometimes physically. But this is no way to run a country. And had they prevailed with this one-party idea, the United States would have never become a democracy. It would have never become a large, complicated, modern bureaucracy. It would have never become a nation state. These people actually had to learn to work together. And that's where someone like Dolly Madison comes in. I say that she modeled a modern form of politics. And the fact that she knew that the salvation of the system lay in cooperation and in working together, and she built bridges instead of bunkers, that marks her as the most modern politician of her time. So if Thomas Jefferson and James Madison couldn't imagine bipartisanship, Dolly Madison did. And she did two things, really, and we can talk about them in detail if you like, but I'll just say briefly. One is she did develop this unofficial sphere where people could come together and learn how to interact and to politic, and they could begin to see each other not just as evil, one-dimensional caricatures, but as actual full human beings. And the other thing that she did was she developed a public persona. She developed it through her clothes and things like that, but it was the character that people talked about, and it was a public persona that was unfailingly gracious and kind and conciliatory. This is not necessarily how she felt. Right. She and her husband had political enemies that they quite rightly despised and feared. But you would never know it to see her. She was the essence of civility. And because she was, people were able to begin to talk to each other and to listen to each other and make the connections that would go a long way to building a democracy. And it's this model of a different kind of politics that she has bequeathed to us, if I may say, put it that way, and that we may want to take advantage of in the upcoming elections. So rather than having people shouting at each other and all that macho posturing on the campaign trail, we might actually begin to construct a politics of civility. And I think we should be reassured to know that Dolly Madison started that tradition, so it's part of our history.
Well, you, I think, though, you argue further that that more than, and not to diminish how important it was, more than working to create this space, this sort of civil, small c, space in which people who had opposing ideas could get together, could actually get to know one another, could talk about things, could work things out. Not only did she create, help to create a space in which that could happen, but she was herself, personally, someone who was a person of political influence, whose influence was sought out.
Oh, unquestionably, unquestionably. And I'll just give you one sort of small example, or at least a category. As I mentioned before, when the founders created this system, they were very eager to disassociate themselves with anything that smacked of courts, you know, absolute power and a king, such as the one in England that we all fought against. And part of the way politics as usual worked in courts was the use of patronage, which, as you know, I can't believe I'm saying this to people in Illinois, but as you know, patronage is the rewarding of money, jobs, titles, whatever, to political supporters. And this was seen as extremely corrupt and, you know, just, you know, dreadful and, you know, treacherous and all that kind of stuff. But again, you can't really run a government without some patronage. I mean, on some level, it makes sense. If you're going to be a ruler, you want to surround yourself with like-minded people. And in fact, that was the problem with John Adams's administration. He was so virtuous, he kept Washington's cabinet, who loathed him and, of course, stood in the way of him the whole time. So it was becoming clearer and clearer as the 1800s went on that patronage had to play a part in that system. But official men couldn't do it. I mean, they did do it, but it was harder for them, and it became the province of women, and especially Dolly Madison. So, you know, if I had to just argue for one category of her political work, I would say it was her incredible ability as an influence peddler. And she staffed the federal government, both at, you know, in Washington City and abroad, with friends, relatives, and supporters. And if one argues that who has the job is important, and I think we do argue that, that was her greatest influence. And people, of course, as you point out, knew that immediately. So they asked her for jobs. They didn't even bother going to James. They just went to her. So she had an incredible influential patronage network.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580, Catherine Allgaier. She is Associate Professor of History at University of California, Riverside, author of a recently published biography of Dolly Madison. The title of her book is A Perfect Union, Dolly Madison and the Creation of the American Nation, published by Henry Holt. We have 7-8 minutes left in this part of the show. There is at least one black mark, I suppose, in some people's books against Dolly Madison, and it has to do with the way she thought about slavery. And the fact that some people would argue that she seemed not to be particularly sympathetic to the plight of enslaved African Americans, and that that was something that would really have been, in fact, out of keeping with her upbringing as a Quaker. One of the things that was pointed to was the fact that, unlike many other people of the time, she did not arrange for her slaves to be freed after she died. What can you say about what she thought about slavery?
I'll tell you, that's, you know, a very important topic, and this is where I have to say, you, in the book, you can see the historian's craft, because there's so many gaps in the record about this, and certainly at certain moments we wish we knew what she was thinking. And one of those moments I alluded to earlier, which was that moment when she's going to marry James Madison and she's effectively returning to a world of chattel slaveholding. Wouldn't we love to have a letter or a diary entry that talked about what that meant? And we don't have that. And she doesn't talk about slavery as a topic in the way that many men did, including James Madison. She has no theories to expound. And so this is where I had to really do some good historical detective work and writing. What I had to do was go through her letters and find these very passing references to slaves and to the institution of slavery at Montpelier and come to a conclusion about it. And what happened was that it became very clear to me that certainly by the time she's talking about this in her middle age, or, you know, 30s or 40s, She has just adopted the attitude of the people of her class. So like other white slave owners of the Virginia gentry, she's, you know, partly affectionate about her slaves, very exasperated with them at times, and she seems to have a kind of blindness about them. So here's this woman who I argue in other parts of the book is incredibly empathic, and she uses that empathic capacity to make connections with people and to figure out what they want. So she's like a finely tuned instrument when it comes to what people need and want. But then at the same time, she can't understand why one of her slaves is behaving badly and steals from her. So she, you know, she doesn't seem to apply human motivation to these people. And what is striking about that is, as you point out, it would be one thing to say, oh, well, she was just born in that world and that's the way she was. But she, though she was born into that world, that wasn't the way she was. She had been a Quaker. So I sort of argue in the book that for anyone to live in a slave society, and this was a slave society, not a society with slaves, but a society built on slavery, you probably needed to develop a certain blindness and a certain denial, and you had to stunt parts of you to just be able to live under such a monstrous system. And I need to point out, too, though, it doesn't make her look great, that it's not as though a different discourse didn't exist. Her cousin, Edward Coles, who was James Madison's private secretary, was of the Virginia gentry. He wasn't a Quaker, I don't believe. He was just a regular guy. And he knew slavery was wrong, and he would go on to perform one of those great acts of American history. He not only freed his slaves, but he moved them to the Midwest and settled them, and he also became the governor of their state to make sure that they were safe. So it's not as though there weren't people around her that understood that slavery was wrong because these were human beings, but she just didn't see it. And in the end of her life, she was so haunted by debt that she sold Montpelier, the family plantation, with the slaves. And part of her motivation was that she wanted to at least allow the slave families to be together rather than breaking them up. But there was definitely a financial move on her part. So in the end of her life, she had very few slaves left, very little to leave to her son, John Payne Todd. So I think that she didn't free them because she wanted to leave something to her son, and slaves were property.
Just, we have a couple of minutes left. I want to go back to the story that I mentioned at the beginning, and again, this being the story that if there's one thing perhaps people know about her, it's the story about her rescuing a portrait of Washington from the White House during the War of 1812 when the British were bearing down on the city and getting ready to torch the place. And one of the things that you mentioned is that, in fact, this particular portrait was a copy of a painting, of a famous painting by Gilbert Stuart of Washington, and as such, it wasn't really all that valuable. Why indeed did she decide? She also grabbed some documents and some other things, so that it wasn't like the only thing that she took. But why is it that was something that she decided was important? And then perhaps why is it that's the thing that so many people seem to remember her for?
Sometimes people are famous for precisely the right reason, even though we don't know it. The story of that day, the day Dolly left in the late afternoon of that day, is very famous. She's actually written about that. She has a letter about it. And that day is famous, I think, for two things. One is that portrait, and also that after she leaves a few hours later, the British come to the White House and they find a table set with food, and, you know, the wine is cooling and in the buckets, and the meat is, you know, on the spit, I mean, ready for this huge dinner. And so we realized that Dolly was throwing a dinner party on the day that, you know, White House is going to be burned. And both of those things, I think, are very symbolic. One of Dolly's jobs after the war, and certainly as invasion neared, was to reassure the city. And the way she did that was the way she knew how, to just reassure them that everything was normal. And it was in those days before the invasion and weeks before the invasion that she had a lot of dinner parties and a lot of social events. And it was a way of keeping the city together and keeping people from panicking. So that final dinner party sort of represents, you know, that impulse that she had. I always think it's really sort of sadly ironic that the British sit down and they eat this meal and then they burn the White House. So the White House which was really all about entertaining. Its last few minutes were occupied with a dinner party. And then, of course, even as she's preparing this dinner party and hoping to keep everybody calm and normal, she is packing away certain things. So she concentrates on documents, on personal papers, but she does take a few other things. But she actually risks her life to ensure that this portrait is saved, because this is the one of the last things she does. It is almost just ahead of the British Army. And so the question is, why? And as you point out, this isn't even the famous Gilbert Stuart painting. It's a copy, and she knew it. And the answer is because of the psychological effect. And Dolly was nothing if not a master political psychologist. And she could not stand the thought of the portrait either being burned or, even worse, being paraded through the Washington streets. So she understood psychological importance. And that's why we remember her, because that was pure Dolly, perfectly appropriate, deeply psychological, always memorable.
Mm. And so you would say, it sounds as if you would, and now this discussion has really done it, but that you would have no difficulty defending the notion that perhaps in her time, when she was alive, she was one of the most admired Americans, maybe, I don't know if it's going too far to say the most, but certainly one of the most admired Americans of her time.
Absolutely. And the key was that, you know, these were rapidly partisan times, and no man could be that person that George Washington had been the generation before, because every man was associated with one party or another. But a woman could symbolize America. She could rise above party politics and represent the nation. And that's exactly what Dolly did. So it was the times, and it was her personality, too.
Well, there we must leave it with more that we could say. If you're interested in reading more about the life of Dolly Madison, look for the book, A Perfect Union, Dolly Madison and the Creation of the American Nation, published by Henry Holt and by our guest, Catherine Allgaier. She is Associate Professor of History at University of California, Riverside. Thanks very much.
Oh, it was such a pleasure. Thank you.